If you could sit down and listen to the person who was invited to develop River Runs Through It, would you check it out? Would you listen to the person who literally brought nymphing to the forefront in the U.S. back in the day? What about a person who could rattle on about the brief history of every person in the U.S. who paved the way for present-day fly anglers and the trajectory that we're on now? Well, today you're in luck because we have Gary Borger back on the show to take a deep dive into the history of fly fishing, to get into tips and tricks, and to hear how he's been doing it for over 60 years. This is the Wet Fly Swing Podcast, where I show you the best places to travel to for fly fishing, how to find the best resources and tools to prepare for that big trip, and what you can do to give back to the fish species you love. Hey, I'm Dave, host of the Wet Fly Swing Podcast. I've been fly fishing since I was a little kid. I grew up around a fly shop and have created one of the largest fly fishing podcasts in this country. I've also interviewed more of the greatest fly anglers than just about anyone in the world. Gary Borger, the author of Nymphing and the book Naturals, is going to share his stories of the people and tips he has connected with over the years. You're going to hear about who the person was who invented the double haul and how Gary is connected to that. You will find out how he developed into the Fenwick fly fishing schools back in the 70s and how that was a major breakthrough back in the day. And you're also going to find out how his first video was actually the first instructional fly fishing video ever produced. Plus, you will hear about the three types of lies that fish use while in the water, how to recognize them, and which of the two you need to focus on this year on the river to catch more fish. Did I mention this was episode 600? We're celebrating. Time to celebrate. If you get a chance, head over to Instagram. If you're over there, leave a comment. 600, and just leave 600 wherever you see it. We're passing 600 and we're moving along. Big celebration. I always love trying to get a big guest on the show at our milestones. So let's go back in history with one of the best. Here he is, Gary Borger. How you doing, Gary?
I'm doing great, Dave. And you?
Great. Yeah, it was awesome to see you. I met you at the show in person, and that was back at in California. But we had you on the episode back in episode 45. So I think we're above 550 now. So we've done 550 interviews or so since we had you on. But the great thing is that we can circle back now, get an update on you. You are, for those that don't know, I think probably most people know you, you're a very well-known name in fly fishing. You've pretty much been there at the start of nymphing and like all this stuff. So we're going to do a little history background on you, but maybe just give a quick update on the last couple years, maybe what's been going on, anything new with you?
Just finishing up some books in my book series. My book series is called Fly Fishing, and I just put out a new book, which is The Perfect Cast 1, book number 6 in the series.
Right. Well, let's hear about that. So talk about this series you have, because this sounds like this is going to be a great resource for people. Take us back to book one and what this is going to look like.
Okay, book one was called Fishing the Film, and that's about fishing in this upper 6 to 12 inches of water, the surface, because that's one of the places that many people have difficulty fishing, especially with dry flies and emergers. So there's a great deal of information on both dry flies and emergers, and also fishing just under the surface with nymphs and or pupa imitations.
Gotcha. Just under. So you're not talking about, yeah, getting down the bottom, but that 6 inches, that upper column.
That's right. The upper column, upper part of the water column. Yeah, that's right.
Gotcha. Okay. So that's and then what is this series? Give us the outline. How many books are going to be in this series overall?
I had planned 20, and I'm still going to try to write as many as I possibly can. We'll see what happens. I'm 80 now. So.
Wow. Yeah. 20 books. Okay. And now these 20 books now, describe the books. Are these short, long books? What are the books?
They're about probably 60,000 to 75,000 words each. They're what we might call moderate length books, but they're pretty intense.
Wow. This is great. And so these, you said the first six are out, five or six. How long until these are all out there, rolled out?
I'd like to be able to do it in a few years, but we'll see.
Gotcha. So it's funny because I go back to the episode we had with John Gearrock a while back. We were talking about books publishing. He said there was a time where he did two books at once, but now he just does one. But it sounds like you're doing multiple books at the same time. Is that true?
Well, I'm planning on multiple books, and I have three more written in the series and another one mostly written. So that I'm doing fairly well in terms of getting them done. The problem, as it turned out, is not the writing of the books. The problem is getting them printed, because printing costs have doubled and tripled in some cases.
Oh, wow.
Just because of the cost of paper, because of the COVID epidemic and those sorts of things that have been going on have increased prices dramatically. So that makes it very hard to publish them at a reasonable price. So I may go to online publishing. We'll see what happens here in the next year.
Okay. And so right now they are coming out as actual physical books.
Coming out as actual physical books right now, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Who are these books, would you say they're for? Are they kind of for a beginner, an intermediate, advanced? Who are they for?
They're probably for intermediate to advanced anglers, simply because there's so much information in there, number one. Number two, if you don't have at least an understanding of the basics of fly fishing, it might be hard to grasp some of the terminology that we use in fly fishing and some of the concepts that we apply in fly fishing.
That's right. Okay, so that's good. So intermediate to advanced. And so talk about, can you describe a little bit of those books? You talked about the first one in the film. What are the rest of them? Or can you give us, if you know kind of what you're doing?
If I can remember, huh?
Yeah.
There's another one on reading the water.
Okay.
Which talks about why fish are where fish are in rivers and your best chances, the best places to fish for the best chance of catching them during various times of the day and various times of the season. And then there's another book on called Fly Gear, which addresses the idea of all the gear that we use in fly fishing, where that came about and how that came about, and what is currently considered to be the best gear for fly fishing. Then there's another one on another one called The Angler's Predator. And that one describes the need for the angler to actually be a predator when they're fishing and actually think like a predator rather than just thinking about going out and flogging the water and throwing a fly and hoping that something takes it. Really about the way in which you have to approach fish and why you have to approach them that way. And the best way to approach them so that you can maximize your efficiency as an angler when you're actually fishing. You
know? Nice. So that's four. Yeah. So you have a bunch. I mean, and you're going to roll these out. So the person that's going to read these, the cool thing is that you have a lot of the history. And in fact, we were just talking, we had an episode on the Golden Gate Casting Club recently that was like a history, and they talked about Jimmy Green. And it was really interesting because they talked about how I'm sure you know Jimmy a little bit since you've been in it, but he has this really, the casting and some of the line development and all the stuff there. Is that part of what these books are going to tell us, some of the historical piece of fly fishing?
Absolutely. Every one of the books has something on the history and development of fly fishing. If we don't understand the history, then we think that either we're inventing something new or somebody hasn't thought of this, or we're missing something that somebody's already put in place and we could be utilizing in fly fishing. So that's part of the reason why understanding the history is so important, because like I said, if you don't understand it, you're just doomed to repeat it. No sense in repeating information that somebody else has already figured out. You might as well just grab that and use it.
Nice. Nice. That's it. So, and you know, history, we're talking to probably one of the best people we could talk to about fly fishing history, because like you said, you're 80, you've been around forever, you've done everything, I think, in fly fishing. Talk about, maybe give somebody who's brand new to our, that didn't hear that episode 45, we'll put a link in the show notes to that one we did, but your history, give us a little summary. You know, what is your, where did you get started in fly fishing? And then, because we also have the River Runs Through It mixed in there along the way, but talk about, is that easy to summarize? Is it easy to take your, however many 60 years, 70 years of fishing and summarize it to somebody right now?
If we got 60 to 70 years.
Yeah, not easy then.
Well, I started when I was 11. I'd been reading magazines that had articles by the then current, professionals in fly fishing that were actually writing. And I thought it sounded like something that I wanted to do. I was already a fisherman. I fished with bait and I wanted to try fly fishing. So I asked my parents for a fly tying kit for my 11th Christmas. And I got the kit. And I started tying flies, and in that spring, I started fishing flies. So I've been doing it for quite a while. 69 years, I guess.
Yeah, let's just call it 70. We'll round up. So 70 years, and it's 24 now. So, yeah, you're going back into the 50s, basically,
yeah,
right?
That's right.
Who were the people in the 50s that were the people you were reading or the big names or mentors for you?
Well, people like Joe Brooks and Al McLean and a young Ernie Schwiebert. And other people, Bergman, and other people of that era that were writing magazine articles on fly fishing. Very few of them talked about casting. Very few of them talked about how to tie flies. Mostly it was, what would we call it, the romance of fly fishing.
Yeah, the lifestyle and stuff.
Yeah, the lifestyle of fly fishing.
Right.
How they'd gone and done this or done that, and, something came up and they saw something new happening and so on. So it was just a very interesting concept, the whole idea of catching fish on flies that you tied yourself. So I just started tying flies and doing that. The book I used was called The Family Circle's Guide to Trout Flies and How to Tie Them, and it was actually published by the Family Circle magazine. It later became Knowles, K-N-O-L-L, Knowles' book on trout flies and how to tie them. It's a very interesting concept. All of the flies in the book were actually painted. They're not photographs, because back in those days, they didn't have the ability to do color photographs and place them into books and so on. It was actually beautiful, beautiful work. And the flies that were tied in there were beautifully tied. So I tried to simulate what my flies looked like compared to what theirs looked like. It was pretty bad, I'll tell you. Some of the stuff I tied was pretty horrible. I wish I had some of those flies, but I had to cut them apart and get the hooks, because back in those days, hooks were very expensive and I didn't have any source of income. This was talking the early 1950s. So there wasn't any source of income for me. I couldn't work, of course, because I was only 11. So I didn't have any money. I didn't have an allowance. So I just all the local birds gave up feathers. You know, either I found them on the ground, or my grandparents had chickens, so I'd use their feathers and just whatever I could get. Grouse when I hunted, and pheasants, and and fur from rabbits and so on. But I did develop the ability to tie flies and the skills to be able to do it, and began trout fishing. I lived in northwestern Pennsylvania near three trout streams. It sort of sounds like River Runs Through It book.
Yep.
But there were three trout streams close by, and I fished all three of those. One was a big one. It's called Sugar Creek. And it always had trout in it, and I was always down there fishing. It also had some smallmouth bass, which I caught too, but mostly I fished for trout. So it was a very interesting and fun time. But then later on, you know, my skills in fishing developed. And later on, I went to college. And where I went to college was Penn State University. And there were any number of good trout streams close by there, of which I fished, especially at Fisherman's Paradise on Spring Creek, which was near Fontaine. And that was a really, really interesting stream, because in those days, it was catch and release only. You couldn't keep any fish. And there were lots of nice trout in there. So I caught lots of good fish, bigger than any I had ever caught in the rest of my life, and more than I ever caught in any one day. So it was really good fishing. And then what happened was I met my wife. She actually started tying flies when she was 11 too. So she's a fisherman.
Wow.
We started fishing together and traveling together and so on. Then I went to Madison University, Wisconsin University at Madison.
Oh, yeah.
To work on my PhD. And we fished there too. And then after that, I got a job in Wausau, Wisconsin, teaching at the university. And then we started traveling and doing a lot of fishing around the world. Well, it was 1 year after I started teaching there, Fenwick hired me as the Midwest director of the Fenwick Fly Fishing School.
That's right. What year was that when Fenwick hired you?
In 1973.
And 73, was Jimmy Green there in Fenwick?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So you knew Jimmy Green well.
I knew him well, yeah. He was not only a great caster, but he's the guy that developed shooting head fly lines. In fact, he didn't actually develop shooting head fly lines in the sense that he developed the concept. What he did do was actually use monofilament as the running line on the fly line, and was able to cast over 200 feet. He's the first person to ever throw a fly over 200 feet, 206 feet, which is a long way to throw a fly, let me tell you.
Wow.
Most people try the best they can and can barely reach 100 feet. But he was an amazing caster, really good caster. But he was taught by some of the best in the world. Marvin Hedge, who was the guy that introduced the double haul, took Jim Green took Jim to Europe to compete in the international contest. And Jim was the long distance caster for the younger people in those days. He was only 17, so he couldn't compete in the adult, but he could compete in the youth competition. He won that. So he learned how to double haul from Marvin Hedges, the guy that actually introduced that to Inda casting in 1934 at the American Casting Games in St. Louis, Missouri. And then Jim, of course, being taught by Marvin Hedge, and Marvin Hedge was actually learned it from another guy in Portland, Oregon, whose name was Mooch Abrams. His real name was Maurice Abraham, but all his friends called him Mooch Abrams for some reason. They must not like to say, you know,
Abraham
or something. I don't know what.
Yeah.
Or Maurice, maybe they didn't like Maurice. Maybe he didn't. But Maurice was actually a steelhead fisherman and got injured in a car accident and couldn't cast as far. So he developed a double haul so he could cast further.
Wow.
And of course, he showed that to the people in the Portland Club. And of course, Marvin Hedge was one of the members of the Portland Club.
Oh.
And he was a tournament caster. So he took that to the, and his longest cast was 147 feet, 10 inches. So that's a long ways to cast a fly in those days.
Yeah.
They were doing this with cane rods and silk fly lines.
And silk fly line. And shoot. But you were saying, Jimmy, so they weren't doing the shooting line back then.
Marvin Hedge actually developed the shooting line, but it was all silk.
Oh, right.
And then when monofilament wasn't developed until 1936 by the DuPont company.
Right.
And so people started using that in their spinning rods and so on. And Jim Green, it turned out, had a spinning rod with 6-pound test line on it. So he used that for his shooting line. And that allowed him to cast, of course, a lot further because there's almost no drag when that stuff flows out through the guides. So he was able to do that 206-foot cast, which was pretty amazing even in those days, even now, because he did that with a silk fly line and a bamboo rod.
Wow.
Yeah, so that's a long ways to throw a fly.
God, that's amazing. Yeah, I think the record now, I'm just guessing, I think it might be like 240 feet or somewhere in that distance. I think Steve Rajeff maybe has it, or...
Steve Rajeff holds it, yeah.
Yeah.
It's a long ways, I'll tell you. It's amazing.
Yeah, 240. Yeah, for most anglers, I think we're shooting maybe 60 feet, right? Or something like 40 to 60 feet, right?
Oh, yeah, 40 to 60 feet, yeah. And for a lot of guys, 60 feet would be a long ways. It doesn't seem like far, but
it
you
is.
Measure about 60 feet and cast it and see how far.
Yeah, when you're at the event, we saw you at the California in Pleasanton. When you're out there doing your casting demonstration, how long are you casting? How long is that length of that pool?
Those pools are usually 70 feet.
Okay, 70.
Yeah, so
yeah.
It's not too hard to cast 70 feet without hauling them, just casting.
Want to experience a magic trick? On a certain river, at a certain time of day, time slows down. Where is this place? Located in the heart of Montana is a place where people go to slow things down, to float down a historic river, and to watch the birds dance across the sky. Watch animals explore the open land, and of course, to fish. If you're looking to slow things down, Helena, Montana is waiting for you. Visit Helena, Montana right now. You can head over to helenamt.com to get a change of pace this year. As we kick off another big season of fly fishing, I'd like to connect you with Drifthook to make sure your fly selection is seamless this year. Drifthook has everything from nymphs to dry flies, hoppers, streamers, and of course, their Euro nymph fly kits. You can order right now at drifthook.com. That's DRIFTHOOK, drifthook.com, and use the code SWING at checkout to get 15% off your first order. What's your best, just on the spot, casting tip? If somebody's struggling to get their longer cast, and what do you tell that person?
Usually I have to watch them cast to see how they're casting. Most people cast with just their wrist and their forearm, which we call forearm casting, which is not very powerful. The whole arm method is actually much better, in which you use your shoulder as the pivot point. That's much better because it's much stronger and allows you to be able to put energy into the line to be able to cast enough distance. I mean, put enough energy so that it will cast as far as you want to cast. The whole arm method was actually developed back in the 1800s. And the Golden Gate Casting Club is the place where they set the record that stood for 35 years. Walter Mansfield, who was the president of the Golden Gate Casting Club, stepped up to the line and made 3 casts. Back in those days, they averaged the best 3 casts. So he made 3 casts, averaged 133 feet. And that in 1899, that was a long ways to cast in those days. You could never cast that far with just your wrist or with forearm casting. You had to use whole arm casting to do that because you can't generate enough energy otherwise. So most people don't really have a good whole arm casting stroke, don't understand casting well enough to be able to generate the energy they need to do the kind of cast that they want to do. And most of them don't understand the basic principles that drive casting. So, I mean, that's another whole story we could...
That's well, you have a book, right? You're writing a book about casting, so that's going to be there.
I've got 3 of them on casting.
3 of them? Oh, wow, this is great. So 3. So let's go back to that 1973. So you're connecting to Fenwick. Talk about that. How did you make that connection to Fenwick?
That's an interesting thing. Actually, what happened was that I was teaching at the University of Wisconsin in Marathon County, and right down the street, about 5 blocks away, was Marathon Waders. At that time, they were considered to be the finest waders in the world. So I walked down there to talk to the guys, And I met the president of the company and had spent a couple of days talking with him about various things about fishing and so on. And I bought a pair of waders, of course, and so on. And then he said to me, he said, you know, we have a fishing program we put on every year that couple it with a local sports show and with a local sport group and with a TV show and and I said, yeah, okay. What would you like me to do? He said, I want you to do something on fly fishing. And I said, well, I've never done anything on fly fishing. And he said, well, why don't you do it? So I put together some slides and I did an afternoon program on fly fishing. And for the end of it, I wanted to show a movie called The Way of the Trout. And it was actually produced in Wisconsin, and it was produced by Trout Unlimited. I said, do you know anybody that has that movie? And he said, yeah, I think the Fenwick rep has it. So I called up the Fenwick rep and he said, what do you want it for? And I told him, and he said, oh, sure, I'll bring it up. So he knew Ted Rudolph, who was the then president of Marathon Waders. So he brought it up, and I showed it at the end of this session, because it was on catch and release fishing. This guy catches this 10-pound rainbow trout, and he decides to let it go because it's going to produce so many eggs and so on and so on.
Right.
That was the theme of the movie. So anyway, so I showed that, and then when I was rewinding the tape, then Jack Sokol, who's the guy who was the Fenwick rep, came in and said to me, have you ever thought of anything about doing anything with this? And I said, well, it's your movie. Because I thought, I was winding the movie back, and I thought that's what he was talking about. And he said, no. Anything, have you ever thought about doing anything with this talk? And I said, it's the first time I ever gave it. He said, oh, okay. So then he left. He didn't say anything to me. Well, about 2 weeks later, I get a call from Fenwick. Turns out it's the Frank Gray who's directing all the schools. Jim Green was actually the guy who was in charge of all the schools. His friend Frank Gray then was going around picking the people who wanted to do it. So he said, we'd like you to come and go through a school with us and see if you want to become the director. So, you know, I said, well, wow. I have to think about that. Okay.
Right. That was a big move. That was like a big job. That was a good position to have.
You know, back in those days, Fenwick was considered the finest fly rod in the world.
Yeah, they were. And were they, in 73, what were they making? What was the rod, a fiberglass rod then?
It was fiberglass, yes. They were all fiberglass. Yeah. But they were the first person to produce rods without metal ferrules.
Oh, right.
And that was Jim Green. He came up with that idea. That's another whole story, but anyway.
Yeah, wow. That's amazing. Yeah, I'm loving this. So we've got a good history track. So basically, you connect with Fenwick. Now you're in the system. You're doing these schools around the country. Oh, is that how that worked?
I did them any place in the Midwest. I was a Midwest director.
The Midwest, gotcha.
Mel Krieger was the West Coast. Frank Gray did the Rocky Mountains. I did the Midwest, and Jim Guilford did the East.
Gotcha. Wow.
Well, I did all this. Then I got another call from Fenwick. Said we have a call from the Pennzoil Company. They just bought this big ranch down in New Mexico, 500,000 acre ranch. They want to hold Fenwick schools there. And I said, they said, would you do it? And I said, of course I would. So we went zipping down there. And for, I think, about 15 years, we did schools down there.
Mm.
Yeah.
Wow. And these schools that you did, were these kind of a couple day sort of thing on the water?
It depended on where we did them. They could be either 2 days or 3 days. If we had the ability to do 3 days, then we would take people fishing the third day. And they could use the skills they developed. But they weren't necessarily on the water. We had lectures on insects. We had lectures on flies. We had lectures on reading water. We had lectures on casting and all sorts of things. And then they would practice casting. We would be there to assist them in the casting. And then once they developed their skills, then if they had a three-day school, then we would take them fishing somewhere.
Take them fishing. That's awesome. It feels like, as you look at somebody trying to get better at fly fishing, either maybe they're new to it or trying to get better, is casting the biggest limitation, or what is it the limit to get that person their first fish? Because I feel like we've heard that a lot, that getting a new person into catching a fish is a really big part of it. What do you think is the most challenging part of fly fishing?
Most challenging part, of course, is casting.
It is casting.
Yeah, the casting, because you have to be good enough to be able to extend the line to a point where it's going to be able to catch fish and not spook them in the process with your presence there. At the same time, you have to be able to not only just do the casting, but handling the line and so on. There's skills involved in all that. They're not terribly hard to learn, but most people have the wrong idea about casting when they start. As a consequence, they never become really, really good at it. Because they never become really, really good, they can't do all the kinds of things that they want to do in fly fishing. And that can be discouraging. So I always tell people, if you're going to go fishing somewhere, go fish for bluegills. because bluegills take the fly quite readily. They're easy to catch. They're easy to play and fight and land and all that kind of stuff. You can develop all the skills that you need. That's the way my son Jason learned all his skills, was by fishing for bluegills.
Oh, it was.
I mean, he caught tons and tons of bluegills. Of course, when we started doing our fly fishing schools in New Mexico, he was 5 years old. So for 15 years, he got to fish in some really great lakes and streams in New Mexico on this 500,000-acre ranch. And as a consequence, he caught more fish by the time he was 10, over 20 inches, than I'd caught by the time I was 30.
Right.
He just, it was amazing how many fish there were down there.
And yeah.
What good fishing it was. So we
That's
just.
That's really cool.
Yeah, he had a really tremendous time doing that.
Yeah. And now you're seeing, doesn't Jason have some grandkids? Or you have some grandkids now, right?
I have grandkids. Yeah, I got two grandchildren. A girl whose name is Brooke.
Uh-huh.
She's 11. And a boy whose name is Finn. And with two N's, not one N.
Yeah. Two N's.
He's 7.
He's 7. Oh, wow. So, and how are they? Are they, have they got out there doing some bluegill fishing or anything like that?
They've gotten out and done fishing. Yeah. Brooke is, yeah. Who's 11, is an absolute maniac fly fisherman. He just loves to do it. Finn enjoys fishing, but he's not quite as intense as Brooke is. Brooke is really intense.
Brooke's into it.
Yeah, she really is.
That's cool. Yeah. And bluegill is probably a good tip for really any, regardless of age, right? If you're brand new to fly fishing, maybe finding a little bluegill pond is a good idea.
Oh, yeah. It's a good idea because you get to handle the fly line, get to be able to learn more about, you get to learn more about casting and handling the line, and also what the fish looks like when it takes the fly and how it feels when it takes the fly. Not only that, but then you get to play them, and bluegills are lots of fun to play. They go sideways in the water and they're broad, and so it's hard to pull them in, and they scrap, pretty scrappy, and they jump and they fight well. And so it gives you a good idea of what trout are going to do when you finally hook the first one of those you catch.
Yeah, and bluegill are kind of spread throughout the entire country, right?
They
pretty
are.
Much any, yeah, any pond, you could probably find some bluegill.
Yeah, they are.
Yeah, cool. All right. So on this time, again, we're going back. This is great. So Fenwick, when did your, what was the book? Because I remember having a shelf when I was a kid on the show. What was your first, that one book that you wrote that was a really...
Yeah, the first book I wrote was called Nymphing.
Yeah, Nymphing. Yeah,
it
Nymphing,
was published in 1979 by Stackpole Books in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania.
Yep.
And the reason I did that was at that time, there weren't any books out on nymph fishing, per se, that were strictly focused on nymph fishing. And I had written quite a number of articles for the Fenwick Lunker Gazette that they published monthly, four times a year, depending upon what they were doing. But so I just sort of collected all those articles and rewrote them in, as a book rather than as simply articles.
Mm.
That was an interesting process back in those days, because you wrote everything out by hand, then put it on a typewriter. And then
right.
I didn't make too many mistakes. And then,
oh, man.
Oh, man, wow. I made a lot of mistakes, of course. And, you know, then send it off to the publishers and so on. So,
wow.
That was 1979 that I published that.
79. Okay, so 70. And I can't remember last time we chatted how much we talked about in between the 80s and 90s, but eventually, you know, The River Runs Through It. What were you doing between that time writing that book and when The River Runs Through It in the early 90s came to be? What was that 10 or 15 year period? What were you up to there?
I did another book called Naturals, which was on.
Oh, yeah.
Which was on all the insects and so on.
Right.
And other food organisms of the trout. And then I did a series of videos.
That's right.
Yeah, we published the first video ever done on, instructional video ever done on fly fishing. That was done in 1982. That was on nymphing also. That was shot on Armstrong Spring Creek in southern Montana. Right, actually near Livingston, Montana.
Oh, okay. Right. And was that something you did with the Fenwick group or on a different deal?
No, I did that with a friend of mine from
yeah.
Stevens Point, Wisconsin. Yeah.
Gotcha. So before this, there weren't a lot of videos out there on fly fishing.
There weren't any videos. Not only that, there's no instructional videos. This was the first instructional video, and it was on nymph fishing, and it actually turned out to be quite a good video. It was in publication for a lot of years.
What was the title of that?
It was just called Nymphing, like the book.
Yeah, Nymphing. I wonder, it'd be great if we could track that down. Do you know if that's online anywhere out there?
It might be online. Yeah, yeah, it might be online.
We'll try to track it down and put a link. Maybe there's a snippet of it. But yeah, so you do this nymphing. And nymphing in the 80s was coming. It was still kind of a new, right, developing.
Oh, yeah. It was.
Yeah.
Yeah. People really didn't appreciate all the aspects of it. And so that's why I wrote the book, because people really didn't understand it. Fly fishermen were all focused on dry flies in those days. The ability to fish sunken flies, even with split shot, and how to cast split shot and all those sort of things. Those were all sort of foreign, and everybody was opposed to the idea of using indicators and shot and all this kind of stuff. There's a lot on that in that book on that. And of course, I got a lot of guff from dry fly anglers about the ability to use split shot and indicators and all that kind of stuff. But so what? I was catching fish. Who cared?
Yeah. Yeah, you're having fun. Yeah. And now it's evolved, obviously. Now there's all sorts of, nymphing is pretty much, I think nowadays it's like any fish, you could catch any species in the world, right? You name the fish around the world, any country, right? When you were doing, were you traveling around the country mostly around the, did you go outside of the country? What were you doing as far as your fishing?
In 82, I went to Alaska and New Zealand and fished both places. And I've spent a lot of time in other countries fishing. But most of the time I fish in the United States because the access is just a lot easier and you don't have to fly overseas and do all that kind of stuff. So,
yeah, that's
and you,
right.
We understand our laws a lot better than when you go to a foreign country, you got to get all the new laws and all the new licenses and figure out how all that
right.
goes on.
Yeah. So I want to hear back to this, The River Runs Through It. You know, this is the great thing because it's still the greatest fly fishing movie of all time, right? It changed the game as far as put fly fishing on the map in the early 90s. How did you connect? Remind us again how you got connected to Robert Redford and the group.
Well, in March of, let's see what year that would have been, 91, I got a call from the fly fishing producer for that movie. And he said, we'd like you to come and work on this movie. And I said, well, I have fly fishing schools all summer. I can't take school off from the schools because I've committed to all these people, so I can't do it. He said, you ought to ask my son Jason. And he said, well, I haven't sent his resume. Maybe we'll make him an intern and not pay anything for the summer. He said, he's not going to work all summer for free. He can work for me in the schools and make money. So they said, well, and then they sort of hemmed and hawed around. Well, have him come in for an interview. And so he sent his resume in, and literally within 2 days, he got a call from Hollywood saying, we want to interview you and we want to do that. And, you know, we said to him, well, we have schools in July. He said, well, as soon as the schools are over, then we'll interview you. So we went and did our schools down at Romeo in July, jumped in the truck, drove 1,250 miles in 1 day up to Livingston, Montana. Then the next day, then we went and were on set and watched some stuff being done there. And then the next day after that, which would have been 2 days after we got there, he was interviewed for the movie, and they hired him right away, as he had experience of shooting video and participating in video, making movies with me all those years.
Oh, right.
Plus, he's an incredible caster, really excellent caster, and teaching casting all those years with me. He had all those skills already available. Plus, he was the right size. He was the same size as Brad Pitt and Craig Sheffer.
Oh, right.
So it was easy for him to become the double for both of them in the movie.
Yeah.
So he got to participate in that. And also, because he'd filmed so much and done so much video work, he actually floated the Gallatin River, which is where most of the movie was shot.
Oh, it was the Gallatin.
Yeah, he floated with the crew on the river and videotaped all these potential places for various shots in the movie. And then Redford would go out there and look at those places and decide which ones that he wanted to use for the movie.
Right.
Since he was the director.
Yeah.
So that worked out really nicely.
Yeah. So basically Jason was, he was a big part of the whole movie. I mean, basically the fly fishing component.
Yeah. Jason actually got to do the storyboards for the fly fishing parts of many parts. I'm not sure he did every scene that had fly fishing in it, but he did many of them because the guy that was supposed to do the storyboards and who did all the rest of the storyboards for the movie wasn't a fly fisherman. So he didn't understand what shots need to be brought into the movie and what shots didn't need to be brought in. So Jason actually helped with that and did all those storyboards. He's a very good artist too. So he was able to draw all those things.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Gosh, that's cool. And Jayden, you moved back, right? You moved back to be closer to your family with Jason and the kid and the grandkids, right?
We've moved to Vancouver, Washington, right? Which is one of the southernmost cities in the state, if not the southernmost. It's right across the Columbia River from Portland, Oregon.
Yeah. How have you been? Like, you've been there a few years now, right?
I've been here 7 years, yeah.
Oh, 7 years.
Yeah, we like the climate here a lot.
And you moved out from Wisconsin.
We moved from Wisconsin where the wintertime was, basically. The only thing that separated Wisconsin from the Arctic was a barbed wire fence. So right. Every time it would get cold, oh my goodness sakes.
Yeah. So you don't mind the rain up here in Vancouver, you can get used to that?
Absolutely. Not a problem at all.
Yeah. Nice. Well, that takes us a little back, you know, to where we are again. And yeah, the movie was pretty amazing. So what, you know, and now you've been doing the show story. How long have you been doing these, the shows with, you know, the biggest fly fishing shows in the country?
Let's see. I started doing speaking engagements at clubs in 1973 when I was the director, the Midwest director of the Fenwick Schools, because a lot of the people that came to the schools in those days were owners of shops and so on that had Fenwick rods.
Oh, right.
And so they would say, do you do this? Do you do this at shops? And I would say, of course I do.
Yeah.
I'd name a price and I'd go do it.
Yeah.
So we had a good time doing that. And then I was hired by a guy by the name of Ed Rice, who did a show here in the West Coast, international fishing shows.
Yeah, he did the one down in California, right?
I did San Mateo. Yeah, I did that many times. And plus I did the ones in Seattle. And, you know, I just, wherever Ed was, I was there. And then Chuck started shows, I think in 1994, maybe.
Okay.
His first show was on fly tying. And then after that, he decided to do fly fishing shows. So he started doing shows, and I think I was in the first one to do one of his shows. In fact, no, I was. Yeah, I was at his first show. So I've been doing it ever since that time.
Right.
And now his son Ben is the director of the shows and the CEO of the company and so on. So now I do them with Ben. But so I've done them all those years.
Yeah, 94. Yeah, 94 is about the time I think River Runs Through It came out. You've over 50 years now. You've been... Pretty much doesn't sound like you've taken much time off. You've just been doing it all, right?
Right. I have been.
when did you retire from your profession, your teaching?
99. I've been doing it for 28 years.
So 99. What was that like when you retired from that and then you basically had some more time? What did you fill that time gap with?
Oh, my goodness sakes.
more presentations, more fly fishing, right?
Lots of both, yeah.
Yeah.
We traveled other places and did more videos, of course. I did a video on New Zealand. I did a video in England. I did a video in several different places. But I also traveled to other countries and did fly fishing programs there. I was in Norway. I was in Finland. I was in Russia. I was in, where else? I did other programs in Germany. I did programs in England.
Oh, wow. So you have got around the world.
But yeah, I've gotten lots of places.
Right.
And done lots of things in terms of presenting information on fly fishing and shooting things and so on and so on.
Yeah.
And I fished in lots and lots of places around the United States and around the world.
Yeah.
So I've had some pretty good time and being able to do these things and also learning from other people in other countries about not only the way you fly fish, but casting and various other aspects of it.
Step into the world where the river whispers and the fishing is nothing short of legendary. This year, I ventured into the heart of eastern Idaho's Yellowstone Teton territory where the fish were larger than life and the waters held the secrets of the best fly fishing out west. Yellowstone Teton territory is not just a location, it's a gateway to adventures that will etch themselves into your memory. With crystal clear rivers like the Henry's Fork and the South Fork of the Snake and enough lakes to keep you going all year long, make your way to Yellowstone Teton territory and embark on a journey to one of North America's finest fly fishing destinations. Whether you're planning your trip now or just dreaming it up, the YTT is where those dreams turn into reality. Remember, Yellowstone Teton territory, that's Teton, T-E-T-O-N. It's time to experience Eastern Idaho for yourself and support this podcast at the same time. When you're at the shows now, part of what is the presentation? I know you do some of the casting. What do you spend your time at when you do the Ben shows now?
I typically do casting demonstrations, fly tying demonstrations, and then PowerPoint programs on various aspects of fly fishing. So quite a few aspects of fly fishing. I might do something on reading the water. I might do something on fishing the non-hatch times. I might do something on dry fly fishing or fishing the film. I mean, I have programs, PowerPoint programs available on all those, about 8 or 9 programs available. I'd have to actually go and count them up. But they ask me to do different ones at different shows. So one show I might be reading the water, and the next show I might do, I mean, I'm usually typically do 2 or 3 of those PowerPoint presentations at any show. So I might do three at one and then two at a different show, and they're different programs. So the people in the area won't see exactly the same programs I did every time.
Yeah. Do you remember when you started presenting, did you ever have any nervousness? Was it something that always was easy for you?
It was always easy because I was a college professor.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And I spoke without notes.
Oh, really? So you would go in without any notes and just off memory?
Yeah, I never used any notes in lecturing at the university. I never use any notes when I'm lecturing on fly fishing.
No kidding. You don't have any, so how do you, what's your preparation? How do you get ready for something that?
I don't. I just.
You don't. You just know it all. You have it in your head.
I just have it in my head, yeah.
Man, that's so good.
It's a lot of information, but.
Yeah. What did you teach in, what was your, as a college professor?
I'm a botanist. So I taught 5-credit botany and 3-credit botany. Mm. 5-credit botany had a lab with it. I also taught a couple of lab sessions of zoology. I taught writing in the sciences, and I taught natural history photography.
Wow.
Occasionally, I would teach dendrology also, tree identification.
Oh, tree, right, trees. Mm-hmm. Okay. And well, let's go back to the Reading Water, a couple of these books. So I want to get a couple of tips out of here. So on Reading Water, you know, this is a tough one because you come up to the stream. Let's just say we come up to a stream. What is a one tip you give somebody on reading the water to help them find some fish?
Look for what we call fishing lies, L-I-E. That's the place a fish holds. It's there for one of three reasons. It's either there for protection, it's there for food, or it might be there for both of them together. So we have a sheltering lie, which is the place fish only go for protection. They're not there to eat, and if you try to catch them there, they won't take your fly because they're scared. There's a feeding lie, which is a place where fish go to find food. Typically, feeding lies are in shallow water because they're typically watching the surface or watching just under the surface for food. The third kind of lie is called a prime lie. It has both protection and food. So they're typically under something, under a bank, under a log, under a foam, under an overhanging bank, under, you know, overhanging trees or something like that. So once you know how to find those and can find the appropriate ones, in non-hatch times when there's no hatch going on, typically you fish prime lies. If there's a hatch going on, or if the fish might be watching the surface because you have ants or something else falling on the surface, then you try to look for feeding lies. And typically I tell people, spend a lot of time looking in the shallow water too, because shallow water areas, even the edge of rivers and edge of riffles, the edge of pools and so on, a lot of times fish will be in there simply because shallower water means it's a lot easier to catch their food. Because it's, number one, they can watch the surface. Number two, shallow water means they're going to be a lot more minnows and crayfish and so on than there would be out in the deep part of the pool. Hmm. So yep. Watching those shallows and fishing those shallows can often be just as effective as fishing the deep water in the middle of the river.
Gotcha. That makes total sense. Okay. And then the protection is the other thing. When they're maybe just down for protection, how would you fish for a fish that's down, that's not really feeding, that's under a protected log or something?
If it's just there for protection, I don't even fish it.
Yeah. Don't even worry about it.
No, don't even worry about it because they're there for protection, which means they're afraid. And if they're afraid, they're not going to take food.
Okay. Perfect. So that's a little, and you mentioned going back to your books, what are, you mentioned a few of the other topics, but you have, let's just go to the fish food. What does that look like? How do you explain for the masses, you know, of like entomology, that whole thing? How do you break it down in the simplest?
I tell people if they're going to really become a fly fisherman, they have to know something about what the trout eats so they can put on flies that match what the fish eats. Typically, trout focus mostly, not always, but mostly on insects, simply because there are so many insects in trout streams and in trout lakes. So they need to know something about insects, not necessarily the name of every insect, although there are people that like to know the name of every insect and need have to know the scientific name because they feel that they're more, I don't know, more enthusiastic or they're more, maybe it's for their own ego, I don't know.
Right, it might be.
Have to know the scientific name of every particular insect. Yeah. That's not essential. What you really need to know is something about the life cycle of the insect and why fish would be focusing on one aspect of that life cycle. That's really the key thing. So if you're looking at one group of insects, maybe they have a nymph and an adult. If you're looking at another group of insects, maybe they have a larva, a pupa, and an adult. So again, understanding that helps you to select which fly you need. Then, of course, I would suggest getting people that know about fly fishing, don't believe everything they tell you because people were going to tell you necessarily things that work best for them in the stream that where they fish, and maybe someplace else that doesn't work as well. And then try to focus on the flies that are being used in competition. Some of those are really superb, even, and maybe just very simple. A fly like the mop fly, for example, was developed in North Carolina, is a super easy fly to tie. It doesn't look like very much, but it catches lots of fish. In fact, it was used by the youth, international youth fishing competition by the Americans to beat everybody else a whole bunch of different times.
Oh, really? And what is the mop fly imitating?
It could imitate a lot of different things. Originally, it was designed to imitate, the inchworms that are found in.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So they're typically green inchworms in the East Coast. And a lot of those get in the water, either floating on the surface or sinking and being near the bottom. So this guy just tied a fly with a piece of mop that's green, the right green color. Didn't even weight it, just fished it that way and fished it on the bottom. Caught tons of fish, and it's still very, very effective. And you can tie it in all sorts of colors, and it imitates something that looks alive. So for fish, that's all you really need, something that looks alive and acts like a natural would act.
Right. So there you go. So the mop fly, what are some other patterns that are your kind of go-to patterns that you're all, if you're out there fishing?
If I'm fishing dry flies, it depends on where I'm fishing and what time of the year it is. I try to have dry flies that are going to look like the hatches that might be occurring at that time of the year. And I might have emerger imitations that look like the emergers at that time of the year. So the time of the year also dictates the kind of fly that you want to be thinking about using. For example, you wouldn't use dry flies in the wintertime, but you can certainly use egg flies, imitate eggs, and you can certainly use mop flies. Other flies that get down on the bottom and look like something alive.
What was your home river when you were out in the Wisconsin area? What was your closest trout stream?
There were several trout streams close by where I lived, but basically we fished the Plover River, which was only about 20 miles from where I lived. That one was a small trout stream, but it had a lot of trout in it, and it was a very good stream because it had lots of insects, and it was a good stream to learn the names of all the insects and how they behaved and so on. And then, of course, I fished all over the place, so in addition to having that one, I had lots of other streams that I fished in the area. The Wolf River was another one. It was a large stream, about probably 45 miles from home. There were lots of them that I fished in that area.
What was going on this time of year, say April, May? Was that a time where it could be still a little cold in Wisconsin?
More than a little bit cold at times.
Yeah, still really cold.
I fished
right?
In the snow many times in Wisconsin on opening day, which was typically the first Saturday in May.
Oh, in May, right.
Yeah, so typically the first insects that hatch were what we call the Hendrickson, which would hatch typically in May, and also blue quills, which would be hatching at the same time.
Yeah. Okay. Gotcha. Yeah. Wow. This is good. So when you look back now with all of, we've talked about some of the history and things, what have you, do you look at anything and think like, hey, I wish I would have done that. I missed that. Or does it feel like it feels like you've done just about everything?
Well, my bucket list for places I want to go is still quite large.
Is it? Yeah. What would be one of those? What would be one place you'd still want to go to?
I still want to go to Iceland to fish.
Oh, yeah, Iceland.
And I fished quite a bit in South America, but I'd like to go down there and fish some more. And I fished a lot of times in New Zealand, and I'd like to go back there again. There still are a few other places in the world for other kinds of fish that I'd like to go. For example, in South America, there's a fish they call El Dorado, which is a golden-colored, it looks like a striped bass, but it's golden-colored. And it's a very, very powerful fish that feeds on minnows and other small fish. So fishing for those would be very exciting. I fished in South America for a fish called piara.
Oh, yeah.
Have giant teeth. And of course, I've caught piranha and all sorts of other things too. But I never caught an electric eel. I don't really want to catch one either.
Yeah.
But I fished in rivers where there were electric eels.
Yeah.
But anyway.
What about steelhead? Did you ever get into the steelhead game?
I got into steelhead game in Wisconsin. There's lots of steelhead in Wisconsin. Also catching big browns. We caught big browns that were up to 36 inches long.
Yeah, right. See, lake run browns.
Yeah, they're lake run browns. They're huge.
Yeah, wow.
Oh, the biggest I caught was 24 and a half pounds, I think it was.
Jeez.
It's big fish.
That's right. Yeah, Wisconsin, we just got finished with an episode with the Muskie Fool Gang. And
oh, yeah.
Wisconsin has a lot of, there's a ton of fishing out. You know, you don't realize it is north, so you have some of the colder weather, but I mean, it's got, yeah, everything pretty much, right? And including some of the best muskie fishing in the world.
Oh, yeah. And also really good northern pike and walleye fishing. Lots of smallmouth bass streams. In fact, maybe one of the best smallmouth bass streams in the United States, Ominy River. And of course, salmon and sea run, basically ocean run, brown trout and steelhead.
Yep.
All those are very good.
And the Driftless area, right? Have you spent much time on the Driftless?
Oh, yeah. I spent some time in the Driftless. The Driftless is called the Driftless because it was never glaciated. All the valleys are just very steep little valleys, and there's lots of smaller streams, spring creeks and other streams in that area. So it's very easy to fish there and a very pleasant place to fish. And it's in the southwest corner of the state.
I'm heading down there with a group for my first time this year. And what should we be expecting? It's all spring creeks, right? What do you love? What do you think is the cool part of fishing like the Driftless that you remember about that area?
The Driftless in the summertime can be pretty rough because the grass grows up nice and tall. The Driftless has a lot of bigger fish, nice fish, both rainbows and browns. And they have pretty good hatches. Also good terrestrial fishing for ants and beetles and grasshoppers in that area, with ants and beetles and grasshoppers in that area. So the fishing's been good there.
Yeah. It's spring creeks, right? It's all spring creeks.
Yeah. So spend a lot of time crawling on your hands and knees, trying to get to the stream without spooking the fish, because they're pretty wild. And the streams are clear, so they can see you easily. And they can see the wind coming in. So make sure you're good at casting.
Right. Yeah. How do you sneak up on a brown trout that's, you know, seen a lot of people? That's just get on your hands and knees.
Very slowly and very carefully.
Yeah. Gosh, this is great. So that's the Driftless. And there is so many places we could talk about. Now that you're in the West, are you getting out doing fishing, or are you kind of doing more writing these days?
Well, I've done a lot of writing. I do get out and fish, and not as much as I'd like to, simply because I don't know the area as well as I need to. But this summer, we're going to do a lot of exploring.
Oh, good.
So I know of some places where there are really good smallmouth bass. Some people consider maybe this best smallmouth river in the United States, the John Day River.
Oh, really?
And the Deschutes, which is down in Oregon, is close by. There's a lot of other streams close by. So the fishing here in Washington State, in terms of trout fishing, is not, I don't have anything that's real close by, unless I want to catch small brook trout, which there's lots of places to do that, which is sort of fun and interesting too. It's tough because there's lots of overhanging branches and so on. So just the idea of being able to get in there and get a fly positioned well on the water is difficult.
Yeah, gotcha. If we were to get some resources from you, you have these books coming out. Does your website have, I know you have a bunch of links there. Is that a good place to go check out some stuff that you have going?
It is.
Okay.
And there's also descriptions of the books.
Oh, good. Okay. And as these books come out, who are they, where can we find them once they, let's just say it's a couple years from now, people are looking back, where's the place that these are all going to be where they can buy some of these copies?
They're typically in bookstores around and online. So if they would go online and type my name in, they could find all sorts of places that have information and all sorts of things about the books. They can purchase them, yeah.
Yeah, perfect. Well, we'll put links out to all those books. And as they come out, maybe we'll keep in touch with you and keep getting some links so people can check them out. What's the next one that you're working on right now? When is that one going to be published?
It's called The Perfect Cast 2. It's the second one in the casting series. There's going to be three in the casting series. Number 2 and number 3 are basically all written. Right now, I'm just trying to figure out how I'm going to do this, whether I'm going to publish them as hardcover books, or whether I'm going to publish them as softcover books, or whether I'm going to have to publish them online. So once I figure that out, then I'm going to be able to put out number 2 and number 3. Then I got a book called Fishing the Non-Hatch Times, and I got a book coming on nymphing.
Okay. Yeah, the non-hatch time. That's always a tough thing, right? With you don't see anything going on, and people, like they say, fish are feeding underneath the surface the majority of the time. But yeah, when there's nothing going on, where do you start, right? That's a big question.
People always ask me, what fly do I put on first? I say, well, whatever fly you want to. There's so many different tactics for the non-hatch times. Basically, all the tactics depend on one approach, which is dead drift with action. That is, you're dead drifting the fly and then giving it some action. So it doesn't matter if you're fishing a dry fly, a nymph, or a streamer. You're going to fish it dead drift for a while, then you're going to give it some kind of action. So there's different ways that we give the fly action. and different ways which we would give dry flies, nymphs, and streamer flies action. So
That's right. It could be like twitching it or skittering a dry, right? That sort of thing could be one.
Right. Yep.
Yeah.
You can fish up and across, you can fish across, you can fish down and across, depending on what you're trying to do with. And so whether you're fishing a dry fly, a nymph, or a streamer fly, there are different tactics that apply to each of those, fishing up and across, or down and across.
Okay. That's perfect. What is the, so you have the show season, is it you, typically in the winter, is that the main thing where you're speaking these days?
Yes. Although I do a variety of Zoom meetings also.
Oh, you do? So you're doing some Zoom for different groups still around the country?
Yep.
There you go. Awesome. And so I guess we could track it down. We'll put links to all this in the show notes for your books. And I think as they come out here, we'll definitely be linking out to your new stuff that's coming. And you think that you can get these done. You said five or six now, and you have 20 to go. So you're thinking maybe if it works out, maybe 3 or 4 years, something like that.
I hope.
All right.
Depending on how we end up publishing them. I mean, if we were going to publish them online, I can do it a little faster than doing it hardcovers.
Oh, right. That's right. What's the hardest part of writing a book or these books?
Just the time is required that is required to actually sit down and physically do them. Because I know all the information. So, I mean, and I have quite a good library of books and so on, of many of which I then cite in the books that I'm doing. And I have a bibliography built into each book that lists all the books that I've cited. So if people want to go back and find other books, they can do that too.
Gotcha. No, see, and then the 20 books, why was it 20? Why not 10 or 30 or any other? Why'd you pick 20?
Just because I picked out all these titles that I wanted to do.
Oh, gotcha.
Whether I'm able to do them all or not.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I love it. I think it's cool. I think you should have, if you can, doing both would be cool, to have the physical and the online, because you could reference all the different books, right? You could have a series of online books on your site. But no, this is great. And I was going to just ask you again, back to the beginner. So I've been asking some guests about this, you know, if you could think back to when you were 11, when you first got started, different time, but what would be your tip you would tell that yourself back then when you were a kid, knowing what you know now, what advice would you give yourself back as an 11-year-old?
Learn how to cast better.
There you go. Well, you've become a casting. I mean, obviously you're an expert. How long did it take you to master the cast?
Oh gosh, I don't know. Casting. When I first started, I was just sort of basically flogging around because I had no idea what casting was all about. But as I continued on, then I started to figure out, well, you got to do this and you got to do that. Back in those days, there weren't any books or any videos or anything at all available on casting per se. But as a few of the books came out with casting, then I started reading those. And when I was young, I didn't buy any books because I didn't have any money. I didn't realize there were books available in the library. So I didn't even go get any books. But eventually, you know, my casting got better because I had to, or I couldn't catch anything. It also got better because I fished with a couple other people, and we would encourage each other and try to figure out better ways to do the casting. And it became pretty obvious, first of all, you can't flog around too much because you scare the fish and you hook your fly and everything around. And so, you know, you have to get good or otherwise you have to quit. So that was one of the things that happened. The other thing that happened was, as I got better and got a chance to fish more places, my casting had to improve, and it did, for the simple reason that if I didn't improve, I wasn't going to be able to catch as many fish as I wanted. Spook a lot of fish. So it just sort of developed that way. And then eventually I began figuring out why different motions had to occur in casting.
Yeah. So you figured it out. You basically taught yourself, but then you had a little bit of help along the way. Who was your first fly casting mentor that, you know, somebody, a name you would know of that kind of helped?
That's a good question. Wasn't any of my friends. Now, by the time I got to do the Fenwick schools in 73, I was a good enough caster.
That's right. Yeah, by that time, by 73, you were already teaching it.
Right.
Right. So you kind of self-taught yourself and did enough to figure it out, it sounds like.
Right.
That's it. I mean, and you said the double hole. I'm going to love going back to these show notes and putting this together because you talked about a lot of names today. Anybody else you would highlight that we haven't covered today? Any names that were influential to you over the years?
Oh my goodness sakes.
Lots. Everybody.
You don't want all those names as well.
Yeah. There's too many, right?
Yeah. I mean, I read lots of books. When I went to Penn State in 1962. Penn State had a very large angling library because many of the professors were anglers. and had written on fly fishing.
Oh. Now, is this Penn State different? Where's the one where, you know, George Daniel is teaching, right? There's the...
He's teaching at Penn State.
Oh, that is Penn State. So Penn State is the place. Yeah. So this is the famous school, right?
Yeah. In those days when I went there, George Harvey was the professor of angling. He was the world's first professor of angling. He actually fished with Ike Eisenhower's brother, who was Milton Eisenhower. Milton Eisenhower was the president of Penn State in those days.
Gotcha. What was George Harvey? What was he like?
George was a superb fisherman. He was also very competitive. If you ever wanted to get George ticked off, all you'd have to say is he'd ask you, how many fish you catch? One more than you, George. He was wild.
Really? What was his expertise?
George's expertise was fly tying, which he taught at Penn State.
Okay.
And also, I mean, he was really a good fly fisherman in all aspects, casting. He also developed the concept of the George Harvey leader, which was a long, very thin, very delicate leader for dry fly fishing so that he didn't get drag.
Oh, similar to like the Euro nymphing type leader, the really thin stuff they're using now.
Yeah, in a sense, but he didn't use it for nymph fishing. He used it for dry fly fishing. And everybody that understands dry fly fishing understands that concept. Longer, thinner leaders that have less drag than leaders that straighten out perfectly straight.
Gotcha. Wow. Yeah. So, and back to just nymphing, you've probably seen some of the Euro nymphing. I mean, that stuff's been around forever, right? Think back when you go back to the early days of nymphing, were people doing anything similar to the Euro style you see today?
No, the Euro style that we see today developed in 1989.
Okay.
And it was actually developed from what we call Polish nymphing, in which they use a very large, extremely heavy fly that sinks to the bottom and just sits there. Then they pull it downstream. And behind it, they have attached a smaller fly. And if a fish takes the smaller fly, it's instantaneously hooked because they're moving the fly at all times.
Right.
That's where Euro nymphing actually developed. Then it became Czech nymphing because the Czechs couldn't cast the big flies, didn't want to cast them with a fly rod. So it evolved that way. So it wasn't around until 1989.
Gotcha.
It was interesting, but George Harvey's leader was actually developed for fishing with terrestrial imitations. It's when the Japanese beetle became very prominent in the East, and it was everywhere, trout were rising and taking them all the time. So George was trying to fish a fish that was taking Japanese beetles, and they wouldn't take his fly. He even designed flies made of coffee beans painted the right color, and they still wouldn't take it. Then he went and stood where the fish was and had somebody cast to him and saw the fly was dragging. So he figured out it was drag that was causing him the problem. So he just tied a longer, thinner leader, and it didn't get the drag, and he got the fish.
Right.
That was very interesting, yeah.
Yes, that's George Harvey. Wow. Yeah, well, this has been great, Gary. I think, like we said, we'll put links out to everything we talked about today as far as your books and your website. And as these things roll out, let's just keep in touch, and I'll make sure to give people a chance to dig into these books. I'm excited to hear these. And right now, so nothing's published yet, right? You're going to start rolling these books out from 1 through 20 as you get ready to do this?
I have the first 6 done.
Oh, so they are published. They're right now. People can get those.
They've been published. Yeah, they're available.
Okay, good. Okay, we'll start there with those books, and then we'll follow up with you as you get the other ones going.
Okay.
All right, Gary. Yeah, thanks for your time. We'll send everybody, and again, GaryBorger.com. And yeah, this has been an awesome episode for sure. I appreciate you going into the history. I wasn't thinking about what we were going to talk about specifically today, but I think the history was good because my dad is, I think he's about 84 now. And I know for him, it's not as easy to get. He's not as conversational as you are. You at 80 are doing pretty well for yourself. So I think that's always good to see.
Another good reason to go out and do all those shows, because I get to talk the whole time while I'm there.
Exactly.
It's good, but yeah, for all those reasons.
Good. All right, Gary, we'll be in touch. Thanks again.
Yeah, appreciate it, Dave. Thank you.
That was good. That was real good. I can't wait to get Gary on for another episode, maybe even Jason as well. Always good to get those guys and hear the updates. Gary is going strong, and there's no signs of him letting up anytime soon. Would love to hear from you if you can. 600, we did it. We're passing 600. We're moving on. The next one is going to be 700, and then we're going to keep rolling along. If you get a chance, please follow this show. That's the best way to make sure the next episode gets delivered right into your inbox. And we've got something big brewing right now. Right now, something really big is going on. Wet Fly Swing Pro is coming up right around the corner. This is something big we're working on behind the scenes, so I'm excited to share this when this comes out. So stay tuned for that. If you want to hear more, you could send me a message, dave@wetflyswing.com, and I'll follow up with you on the details there. And stay tuned this Friday, Adam Hudson, Battle of the Boats. Me and Adam are going to battle it out to find out which is the better boat, the raft or the drift boat. You got to check that one out. This is a good one. Adam from Blue Line Flies is back again, and he is going to break out some good stuff. He always brings his A game. All right, I'm going to get out of here. I appreciate you for stopping by today. Hope you have a great evening. Hope you have an excellent morning or a spectacular afternoon. And I look forward to seeing you on that next episode.
Thanks for listening to the Wet Fly Swing Fly Fishing Show. For notes and links from this episode, visit wetflyswing.com.